on September the 28th last year. And actually, looking back, I was the lucky one. I could have been called by the Americans and been sitting in Camp X-Ray by now. When I was captured, I was absolutely terrified. I'd read and fallen for all the propaganda that I had been captured by the most evil, brutal regime in the world. Not only that, they hated women. So I thought my chances of seeing the sunset that day were fairly slim. In fact, what I found amazed me, I was treated with great courtesy and respect by these people, and most of the fear that I felt came in those moments when I was left on my own and only had my imagination to play with. One of the things that I decided to do, though, was to avoid the subject of religion altogether. I knew very, very little about Islam. All I knew was that they were very fanatical in their beliefs and their passions, and I just thought I needed to steer well away from this subject. And I successfully did that for about 5 days, during which time I was questioned on everything from who is your father's father, to who is your, you know, have you any brothers, and who are your uncles, and who are their uncles' uncles. My father's father was a bit of a black sheep, so we never discussed him in the family, and to this day I still don't know his name, other than Mr. Ridley. And the Taliban were appalled at this. They said, "You must know who your father's father is." I said, "I don't. He's called Mr. Ridley." I didn't exactly want to tell them, you know, about being the black sheep of the family, but they weren't entirely convinced by this. And in the end I said, "Well, who do you think I am?" And they said, "We think you were a secret American spy," which prompted me to burst out laughing, and I said, "Well, if I am America's secret weapon, then God help America." In the end, the questioning went on quite extensively, and it was always the same. You know, they were obsessed with the male line in my family, and unfortunately, there's only my father. I have two sisters, we all have daughters, and so men don't really feature a great deal in the Ridley family, which I think they found rather disconcerting. Anyway, on the sixth day, I was visited by a cleric, and I was, again, very, very frightened. This very tall, elegant man with a white turban and white flowing gowns walked in to see me, and I sat down, and I could feel my mouth go dry, my hands go wet, and I thought, you know, I'm in serious trouble here. And he asked me what my religion was, and I said that I was a Protestant Church of England. And he then said, "What do you think of Islam?" And I said, "Oh, it's a wonderful religion. I'm very, very impressed with it. I'm so impressed with the passion with which your men follow, because everything stops the prayer 5 times a day, as it knows." And he said, he nodded approvingly, and he said, "So, you would like to convert?" And I thought, if I say yes, he'll go, "Fickle woman, take her out and have her stoned." If I say no, he'll say, "You know, how dare you be so offensive to Islam?" And I'm sitting there, and the seconds are ticking away. And in the end, I said, "Well, you know, I'm very, very flattered that you've made such a generous offer to me, but I don't feel able to make such a life-changing decision while I'm in prison. However, if you let me go, I promise I'll read the Quran when I get back to London." He smiled at me, didn't say another word, and left. I was then taken up to Kabul and locked in a 5-meter by 7-meter cell with 6 Christian fanatics. So after 4 days of that, America and Britain started to bomb, and I was in Kabul when they dropped 50 cruise missiles in two sections of the area within a quarter of a mile of the prison. It was truly, truly terrifying, and again, I thought that my life was in danger, but this time not from the Taliban, but either from American or British bombs. Thankfully, I got through that night, and the next day, the Taliban, who'd said that they were going to release me, kept their word despite the start of the war. And so I was kicked out of Afghanistan because I had entered illegally. In fact, during one conversation, they said to me, if we came charging into Britain without a passport and visa, what would happen to us? And I just thought, Belmarsh. Anyway, after 10 days, I left, and the world press were waiting for me to dish the dirt on this really, truly brutal, evil regime. Unfortunately, people have different reactions to the truth. And when I came out and said, actually, they weren't that bad, and they treated me with courtesy and respect, people were outraged. What they wanted to hear was that I'd been abused, I'd been tortured, I'd been raped, all sorts of terrible things, because it's so much easier to drop bombs on horrible people than to drop bombs on people who treat you rather well. And while I wouldn't sanitize the Taliban regime because their treatment of women was bad, as I say, I could only speak as I found, and they did treat me with courtesy and respect. There was one question mark. The day before I was asked if I would like to convert to Islam, I was given a wedding dress. And I wasn't quite aware of what it was at first. I just thought this was a bit elaborate for prison wear in Jalalabad, but, thank you very much. After I declined the offer to convert to Islam, and I was sent up to Kabul prison, I was then packing my little goods and chattels, and the fellow prisoner said to me, why have you got a wedding dress? And I said, but I really wasn't sure what it was. And then I told them about the cleric coming to visit me, and they said, they obviously wanted you to convert, and they had a husband lined up for you. I said, well, if that's the case, some man has had a very lucky escape. After that experience, when I came back to London, they had kept their word, I kept mine, and I started reading the Quran and talking to various Islamic clerics and academics. And it was only ever meant to be an academic study and just to keep my word. But with each page that I read, I thought, this isn't what I expected. This is actually quite a revelation. Obviously, I went down the index of the Quran that I was given, translated by Yusuf Ali, and I went on to all the women's issues first to read about how you're all horribly subjugated, beaten, brutalized, kowtowing and to your men. And it was quite a revelation. The property and divorce laws could have been written by a Hollywood divorce lawyer. The other issues, acknowledging women's equality and spirituality and education was a breath of fresh air. In fact, it's every Muslim's duty to be educated. And there was a section that acknowledged that we aren't the same as men, and I thought, yes, I found it. This is the bad bit. But it just said, we aren't equal because you have children, you breastfeed, you have periods, and so you have these additional burdens. And I thought, yes, we're like the deluxe model of the human being. This is a great acknowledgement. And so a lot of the myths that have been peddled very successfully down the centuries by crusaders, I realized were exactly that, total myths. The next big revelation was meeting Muslim women at various Islamic groups up and down the country. And again, the popular view is that Muslim women are very shy, retiring creatures. I have never met so many opinionated women in all my life. You're absolutely amazing. And, you know, I really salute you all. Every sister that I've met has got tremendous resilience, a lot to say, a very powerful and articulate way of expressing themselves, you know, just absolutely wonderful. And that was another, you know, really breathtaking thing for me to take in. And so then this academic study began to become more of a spiritual journey for me. And so I was quietly reading more, seeing more groups, taking in more opinions and views from Sufis, Sunnis, Shias, anybody, any group who would talk to me, and I would talk to them to get different views. And this was going very well until about 3 weeks ago, the Evening Standard Diary, which is a gossip column, was tipped off that Yvonne Ridley was about to embrace Islam. And she was taking tutelage from Sheikh Abu Hamza al-Masri. I got this phone call from this journalist who said, is it true you've converted? And I said, no. But I am thinking about it, and I am studying, and I'm not quite sure how far I am with my journey, but I'm quite confident that I will convert. And then he said triumphantly, is it true you're taking tutelage from Sheikh Abu Hamza? And I said, he has given me a couple of books. We met at the Oxford Union during a debate, and he was interested in my views, and he gave me some tapes and books. And that is the extent of the contact I've had. Well, if you'd read the Evening Standard the next day, you'd think that Yvonne Ridley was about to open a madrasa for Al-Qaeda recruits. Once it became public, then other parts of the English media seized upon it. And my mother rang me up. And, you know, what's this about you becoming a Muslim? And I said, I told you I was reading and I'm studying. And her reaction was similar to that of many other people. You'd think I was applying to become the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, had I said I was going over to Catholicism or become a Methodist, nobody would have said anything. And religion affects people in very different ways than journalists. I mean, in my profession, they were horrified. They don't like religion of any sort. You know, they're all hard-drinking, hard-bitten, cynical hacks who think that they can cope with anything, and they get very nervous when you talk about religion. And when they heard, you know, some of my closest colleagues who were saying, they had to find a reason for this. You know, she's been brainwashed. Oh, she's suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. This was picked up in the American media because they needed to justify why Yvonne Ridley, of all people, would take an interest in Islam. Well, if you ever had the chance to meet any of my captives, I think you can blow the Stockholm Syndrome list. Stockholm Syndrome, for those of you who don't know, is when you become quite empowered by your captors and compliant, and you become to follow their views. If you had met any of my captors, they would have told you that I was rude, horrible, spat and swore at them, and they were glad to see the back of me. So there was no bonding there. Considering I spent the last 4 days of my time in Afghanistan locked up with 6 Christian fanatics, that's when Stockholm Syndrome should have kicked in, and I should be in America's Bible Belt now with my tambourine. Anyway, I'm not. I'm here addressing an amazing meeting of fantastic women. So anyway, since I left Afghanistan, I have actually been back twice, and I've also been to Iraq and Palestine, and it's the latter two that I'd really like to talk to you about. I went to Jenin about two, three days after the Israelis pulled out. And what I saw there was truly horrific. As the UN said recently, there wasn't a massacre. I mean, I would like to know what a massacre is, because I read in the newspapers the other day about a massacre of 10 in South America. We know that at least 64, 65 people died in Jenin, many of them women and children. When they went into Jenin, they used bulldozers to flatten homes with people still inside. In fact, when I was there, there was one family trying to recover the body of a relative who was in a wheelchair, who was trapped in his home while this bulldozer brought it down around his head. F-16 jets, the parts of which Britain supplied, Tony Blair says if we didn't do it, somebody else would, are being used against civilians. And over a series of days, F-16 jets were used to shell Jenin, tanks were used to shell Jenin, Apache attack helicopters were used to attack civilians, Palestinians were used as human shields by the Israeli soldiers, who also robbed Palestinian women of their jewellery and any precious belongings that they had. The men were rounded up. Some of them were actually bound and tied and had registration numbers written on their arms. Now, then the last time I was in Leicester, I was describing this, and I said that this was Nazi-style tactics. I was challenged at the end of that meeting that how dare I use the term Nazi, because, you know, these were people, you know, from the Holocaust. And I said, no, where, you know, the tactics that they used could have come out of any concentration camp, could have come from any Nazi. And the woman, although she said she was sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, said she was Jewish. And the trouble is, with a lot of Israelis in particular, they are in total denial, from the very, very top to the very, very bottom. And you see it every day on television when a journalist will say to Mr. Sharon or a member of his cabinet, your soldiers went in and shot an innocent woman. And they never answer that question. They either deny it or they go on about suicide bombers. This was another issue that I brought up when I was in Leicester the last time. I said that the suicide bombers are martyrs. And while I could never speak for God, I have a very good feeling that those suicide bombers are in paradise. Because those people, you know, what makes a 15-year-old boy strap explosives to his body when he should be out having a good time with his friends, playing football, just having a good time? At 15 years old, makes that decision to end his life. We saw the emergence a few months ago of a young Palestinian woman who was a volunteer ambulance worker who went and blew herself up. What made that woman, with a full life ahead of her, with a, you know, to get married, to have children, what made her want to blow herself up? For months she'd been a volunteer ambulance worker, a carer, someone who helped people survive, and suddenly she went out and blew herself up. And what makes people do something like that is when they have had all the hope squeezed out of them so that they have no hope left, they have nothing to go. These aren't angry, nationalistic people. These are people who are left with no hope and no despair. And when I went around Jenin, I met a 9-year-old boy who was sitting in the rubble. His family are trying to retrieve and salvage what they could from what was their home. obviously they were talking about, don't worry, we will rebuild. And the little boy, he spoke English, and he turned around to me and he said, it's pointless rebuilding because they will come back again and they are flattened. There is no hope. This is a 9-year-old child, the same age as my daughter, and he'd given up. And I looked around at the other children and I thought, how many Bin Ladens, Abu Nidals, whatever, are going to rise from the ashes of Jenin because of this brutal Israeli action? Another person who was in Jenin at the time was the journalist John Pilger. He has just completed a documentary which will go out on ITV, the network, sadly at 11 o'clock at night, but you know, nevertheless he has managed to make this stunning documentary, and I think it's going out on September 11th. And one of the people who he interviews is a man whose daughter died as the result of a suicide bomber. And this Israeli man told John Pilger, the bomber who killed my daughter and my daughter are both victims from the same situation. They are both victims. This man belongs to an organization which I think is called The Circle, where the victims of suicide bombers and the families of suicide bombers have actually found a common thread and a common bond, and they've got together. You won't read about it in most of the mainstream papers, and you certainly won't hear about it in any American publications. But those little, if people like that can find a common bond and a thread and try and fight against the Zionists, then, you know, not all hope is lost. There was something else that was very strange when I went around Jenin. For the first hour, I couldn't look anyone in the eyes. I'm walking around with my head down and I couldn't understand it. I thought, well, I'm not Israeli. I wasn't flying this jet. I wasn't behind this bulldozer. And I couldn't understand why I felt so ashamed. And eventually I realized, I thought, I am a human being. How can one human being do this to another? And that was quite an awful feeling. And you just realize how desensitized the Israelis must be to be able to carry out these atrocities and then walk away and seemingly not feel anything. Anyway, the other subject was Iraq, but again, there's a very common theme running through, because let's be in no doubt that the heroic resistance of the Palestinian people have so far delayed the war on Iraq. Right from the child that's thrown stones to the suicide bombers. As I said before, you know, these people are martyrs. And sadly, the last time I was in Leicester, I was criticised for that, but if you're here again today, wherever you are, I make no apologies. Recently I met Scott Ritter. I don't know if you've heard of him or not. He is an American UN weapons inspector, absolutely loathed and reviled by the Iraqi people, and he made the Iraqi regime's life a misery when he was in there with a team of UN weapons inspectors until 1998. He is very much against the war on Iraq. As far as he is concerned, they did destroy all the weapons of mass destruction. He's confident that their team got about 95% of all chemical and biological weapons. And despite what the Americans would have you believe, you can't just make a chemical biological bomb from the kitchen sink. You need a lot more technology. And because of the UN sanctions in Iraq, they haven't been able to get any sort of equipment that's got a dual purpose into the country. If there were any chemical weapons left, they'd long gone past their sell-by date, and so by that reason they've been rendered harmless. These are the views of an all-American hero, a Marine, a former intelligence officer, who, as I say, is very much against the war in Iraq. He was asked, how much influence does our Prime Minister, Tony Blair, have in America? Now, I don't mind slagging Tony Blair off, but when you hear an American say it, it really sticks in your throat. He said, oh, the Americans love Tony Blair. He's fantastic. He's our tame, docile little puppy dog, and when we tell him to roll over, he rolls over. And as I say, it's easy for any of us to say that, but when you hear an American say it, it does stick in the throat. And again, he was asked, but what sort of influence does he have? Oh, absolutely none. As long as he's with us, we're fine. You know, if he's against us, he can clear off. He has no influence at all with the American people. I think somebody should tell Tony, but anyway. One thing that we have seen in the last few weeks is a real change in public opinion, not just in Britain, but in America as well, where people are questioning the validity of an attack on Iraq. And this is down to people like yourselves, individuals who have made their voices heard, and who've also got together collectively and made themselves seen as a force. And, you know, we've talked before about September the 28th this year, Trafalgar Square. You know, you've got to make sure that you're part of that millions man march, because it's going to be an amazing event. As a result of all this pressure, all this public opinion, all the dissent, the letters, you know, from the letters in the local Less than Mercury, two letters in the Times, it's all had an impact, and now more than 160 MPs have signed an early day motion against military intervention in Iraq. More than 200 Labour MPs are unable, because of protocol reasons, to actually sign that petition, so we could have another 200 that are supporting in the wings. And we do know that half the Blair cabinet is split. We know that Robin Cook and Claire Short have made it known that they're against any sort of military action in Iraq. Gordon Brown hasn't been that strident, but friends of Gordon Brown have had off-the-record briefings with journalists saying, oh, Gordon's not very happy about this. So we know that there's quite a divide going there, and even Blair, who's intoxicated with power, is starting to sober up on this fact. I mean, we have been friends with America for over 60 years now, and what we should really do, and what the world is doing, is putting America under the microscope. And basically, I think it's fair to say that we're all fed up of the hypocrisy. I said at a recent meeting that there was very little difference between George Bush and Saddam Hussein. One is an evil tyrant with weapons of mass destruction, and one is an evil tyrant who would like weapons of mass destruction. They also have something else in common. Neither were democratically elected. In fact, you know, the American administration has banged on for quite a long time about let's get the UN in here, let's get these weapons inspectors back. I think during the run-up to the next American presidential elections, we should have a UN UN inspection team in America, because those people are being denied democracy. The scandal of the vote rigging in Florida, which swung the votes for Bush, was widely reported over here, but denied to the people in America. Both regimes have experimented illegally with biological and chemical weapons. But the Bush administration's plan for preemptive war against Iraq so flagrantly violates both international law and common morality that we need to get a real debate going. I think we have to do it in areas like this because democracy is being denied by Blair at the moment. He is refusing to recall Parliament to have any discussion at all on Iraq. Any discussion should begin with the recognition that an attack on Iraq would constitute an attack on the Charter of the United Nations, since the United States would then be in violation of several provisions, beginning with Article 1, Section 4, which states, "All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat of use or force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state." Since Bush bullied and cajoled and conned his way into the White House, he has torn up more international treaties and UN conventions than the rest of the world put together in the last two decades. It's been quite breathtaking. America has also refused to allow chemical weapons inspectors into its own government laboratories. You have to ask why. America has undermined the International Criminal Court. Of course, we know why. We know why they want to be exempt. We're starting to hear about the real criminal atrocities that have happened in Afghanistan. And it's quite obvious that American special forces, if not to part, just supervise the slaughter, the wholesale slaughter of some of the Taliban soldiers. They've flouted environmental laws and climate control protocols. I mentioned Camp X-Ray before. As I say, I went into a country without a passport, without a visa. I broke the rules, I broke the law, and in theory I should have been charged. But I was released on humanitarian grounds. We have yet to find out what any of these soldiers in Camp X-Ray have done. You know, they haven't been charged with anything. They're still being denied access to lawyers, to human rights organisers. They're being denied access to the outside world. There's growing evidence that America are using torture tactics on these men, who Donald Rumsfeld described as the most dangerous, the worst of the worst. The reality is they've got some kids from villages in Afghanistan locked up in those cages. There are no Mr. Biggs out in Camp X-Ray. And alarmingly, there are at least six British men out there, and our government is doing absolutely nothing to help them. It's outrageous. And now Bush wants to go to war with Iraq. The developments over the last couple of days with Saudi Arabia have been quite amazing. They said, no, you can't start or launch the war or use our airspace. And this is quite simply because the Saudi royal family are terrified. They're looking over at Iran. They saw what happened to the Shah in a matter of weeks. They're looking at their own people. The whole concept of bin Ladenism exploded because there are 2,000-3,000 American troops hidden away in the Saudi desert. And George Bush wants to put 250,000 into the region. And the Saudi royals know that their people won't stand for it. So they are saying no to America. And now the Bush aides are saying, oh, well, the Saudis are no friends of ours. So no doubt they'll end up in the axis of evil. Jordan's monarchy is also in turmoil because Bush wants to start one of the invasions through Jordan, where over 2 million Palestinians are living, and they are not going to sit back and let that happen. In the meantime, everyone is watching Israel because they're really concerned that if Bush does launch this war against Iraq, Israel will then have a huge sweep of ethnic cleansing through the West Bank during all of the confusion and trying to get away with what it wanted to do for many years, which is eradicate all Palestinians from the West Bank. They're not bothered about Gaza, they want the West Bank. So why does George want to go to war with Iraq? First of all, we're told Al-Qaeda. This is part of my war against terror. And there is no evidence that there is any Al-Qaeda activity in Iraq. Newsnight journalists, a few months ago, got their hands on a satellite telephone which had been used by Osama bin Laden. There were calls to scores of countries around the world, including America. Not one call was made to Iraq. There is no evidence. It's not Saddam Hussein's sort of thing, and it's just inconceivable that he would be backing Al-Qaeda. Then he was told, the anthrax. There was a terrible anthrax scare in America. This has got to be the work of the Iraqis. And when the CIA and the FBI got down to it, it looks as though it was started by a rogue scientist from America who didn't get the job he wanted, and so started to post out anthrax to fellow Americans. So the anthrax issue is merely an internal murky domestic affair and certainly not the work of some rogue state. Bush has then called for a regime change. I mean, he called for it in Palestine. How dare he? You know, who does he think that he is? And now he's saying, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein. Why? He obviously forgets that it was America who supported the Iraqi regime when it massacred thousands and thousands of Kurds. He obviously forgets that it was America that armed Turkey, who also massacred thousands and thousands of Iraqi Kurds. You know, when you look at the American record and you look at other nations which killed hundreds of thousands of their own people, i.e. Indonesia, Guatemala, they've all had weapons from America. But Bush continues to say, no, we're all at risk from Saddam Hussein. You know, he went into Kuwait, he marched into someone else's country, and you feel like saying to George Bush, well, excuse me, didn't you march into Vietnam, Cambodia, Grenada, Panama? Those are the ones we know about. We know that covertly been up to dirty tricks in other countries. Then he says, Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction. He, why should Saddam Hussein pose a threat to us now? He's no more dangerous to us now than he was 12 years ago. You have to sort of look historically at the Americans, as I mentioned before, just to see the gross hypocrisy in their words. George Bush calls Ariel Sharon a man of peace. I have to tell you, an American Islamic cleric described George Bush as a man of vision recently. Unbelievable. You know, when you look, what country has by far the largest store of weapons of mass destruction in the world and has used them to the deadly consequences of millions of people, i.e. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. The biggest threat to world peace at the moment is coming from America. A strike against Iraq would be illegally and morally bankrupt. And we have to get this message through, and it is getting through, to Tony Blair and his cabinet and his politicians and those MPs who have yet to sign this petition. You can all help, you can all write, send emails, put pressure on, and I hope that you all turn up to Trafalgar Square on September the 28th. Because when I was in Iraq, I actually saw the reality of what American bombs can do. I went to the Al Alamira bomb shelter, where more than 450 women and children hid during one of the nights that America rained bombs down on Baghdad. One of their bombs, a laser-guided missile with deadly accuracy, went straight down an air ventilation shaft into this bomb shelter, where 408 women and children lost their lives. The place exploded, incinerated, the metal ceiling turned molten. Children who were in their beds were thrown up to the air, their skins melted on the ceilings. When I walked around that shelter, I saw the digits from their fingers and toes still stuck, petrified, onto that ceiling. There was one ghostly shadow of a mother who'd obviously tried to protect her child as the second bomb, another laser-guided missile, came in. And those that had survived the first blast and were running round or trying to get out of the way were then hit in the second wave. Those people didn't stand a chance. 408 women and children. When I went there, I just wished that I could have dragged Tony Blair around to see the reality of what these bombs do to civilians. The truth is, the real reason why America wants to target Iraq is that it is in dire straits financially. Its corporate image is in tatters because of gangster capitalism. And nothing galvanizes the country more than a war. The Falklands War, which I actually happen to believe in, swept Margaret Thatcher to power. And obviously Bush is hoping to galvanize his people behind him by going in to go into Iraq. But the greatest threat, as I said before, is not from Iraq, Iran, Syria, or wherever else he picks, you know, to be part of this axis of evil. You know, even Osama bin Laden pales into insignificance. The most dangerous person in the world today is George Bush. And some, you know, Tony Blair has got to have the guts and the mandate to stand up and resist him. You know, how long is Blair going to allow the UK to be used as a doormat for the Americans to wipe their feet on every time they feel like it? I mean, I have a salutary message for Tony Blair, who has become the self-styled 51st governor of the United States. The last man to go trotting around the world threatening people with somebody else's army was called Mussolini, and we know what's happened to him. The mood is changing everywhere, and you know, the American people might have given George Bush a blank check for his war against terror after September 11th, but even they are now starting to wake up and smell the coffee. The outrage over September 11th, which I personally believe has its roots wrapped around Palestine, is just as strong. But now there's a feeling of caution that is sweeping in. And the latest poll shows that only 53% of the American people support any military action in Iraq. That's quite amazing, because just a few months ago, Bush had more than, I think it was 87-90% of the support of the American people. And it isn't because they think Saddam Hussein is an okay guy. We all know he's an evil tyrant, and we all know he needs to be removed. But this isn't the right way to go about it. and they know that. Bush's personal ratings are dropping. Tony Blair's personal ratings are dropping. So, you know, we've got to get this message through to Blair that he can't stand shoulder to shoulder with that man anymore. You know, we live in a global village. We can't stand shoulder to shoulder with the global village idiot, which is what George Bush is. As I said before, the situation of Iraq and Palestine are linked. And the biggest fear at the moment is that if this war starts in Iraq, then the attention of the world will be totally diverted, and that is extremely dangerous for the Palestinians, because that is when Israel could move in and continue and carry out the ethnic cleansing which they are doing at the moment. I hate to end on a downbeat note. As I said before, you can each and every one of you make a difference by writing one letter to your MP, to your local council, to your newspaper, collectively. I mean, you know, what a magnificent sight in front of me. You know, collectively, I'd like to see you all down in Trafalgar Square on September the 28th. The suffering of the Palestinian people is horrendous, and they think that they are being abandoned and neglected. And they know what's happening, and they will hear about September the 28th, and when they hear how successful it is, it will lift them and raise their spirits and give them the encouragement to fight on. You know, and my God, if we can't do that for them, you know, then we're not worthy, and we're not worthy of being friends of Al-Aqsa. You know, we have to help those people, and we can do it positively and peacefully and make a huge impact with the government just by turning up and being there on September 28th. Thank you for listening. Thank you to the Intifada.